So what did we do? We stepped in and had the toughest reforms on Wall Street since the 1930s. We said, you've got banks, you've got to raise your capital requirements. You can't engage in some of this risky behavior that is putting Main Street at risk. We're going to make sure that you've got to have a living will so we can know how you're going to wind things down if you make a bad bet, so we don't have other taxpayer bailouts. In the meantime, by the way, we also made sure that all the help that we provided those banks was paid back every single dime with interest.
Former President Barack Obama defending his Wall Street reforms during a 2012 presidential debate. Those reforms, collectively known as the Dodd-Frank Act, were signed into law in 2010 after the financial collapse. They reshaped the way Wall Street and the American banking industry function. Well, earlier today, President Donald Trump ordered a review of Dodd-Frank with the intent of rolling back significant portions of the law's financial industry reforms. Here to break down the law and what its dismantling could mean is business journalist Heidi Moore. She's currently editor-in-chief at The Ladders. Welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Well, tell us briefly about Dodd-Frank. What did it do?
Sure. So Dodd-Frank came out of Congress's desire to stop another financial crisis. It came in the heat of trying to fix the financial system after the crisis and address all the problems that we saw in the financial system, the creation of those toxic mortgages, the banks that underwrote risky derivatives. And so there were a lot of things that Dodd-Frank tried to do, which was fix all of these problems. It didn't really do them. What it was a 900-page to-do list. So they said, we want to address all of these topics, but a lot of it was just sort of suggestions or vague, we'll get to this later. So the legislation itself said very little about how to fix things, but there were four major things it did try to fix. So one was creating a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to help consumers understand what they're getting into when they sign a mortgage and to protect them against the activities of the big banks. Another thing was to get banks to reduce their risky behavior. So when you put your money in your checking account, you think that's your money. But in fact, it's going to the bank, and the bank is using it to make loans. And a lot of these banks were not only using your money to make loans, but they were using it to bet on derivatives and to bet on risky things in the global markets. And Congress wanted to stop that. So it created something called the Volcker Rule, named for Paul Volcker, the former Federal Reserve Chairman. Mm-hmm. And it said banks can no longer use your money to do their own risky trading that only makes money for them. It doesn't make money for you. And then they told banks, you heard President Obama talking about the living will. Essentially, they told banks to write down every single thing they own, which, of course, is impossible because what banks own changes every single day. How many times do you cancel an account? How many times do you pay off a loan? So it was very hard for them to keep track of that, and that never really got done. And then the last thing was to protect consumers from banks trying to sell them things. So if you have a financial advisor, if you have enough money that you can go to a financial advisor and ask for advice, you think that person is working for you. But in fact, they're working for a giant financial organization that wants them to sell you things, right? Sell you things like annuities or insurance policies or mortgages or other kinds of checking accounts. And if they're working for you, they're probably not going to sell you those things. But if they're working for the giant financial organization and the giant bank, they can sell it to you because then they make a commission on it. So those were the four major things that came out of Dodd-Frank. And quite frankly, Wall Street hated it from the beginning, and they really fought against it. It's basically essentially been dead since 2012. So the president's executive order, which we don't know the text of right now, is probably just going to formalize that death.
Okay, so let's take that last bit, that thing that you were talking about in terms of financial advisors. That's called the fiduciary rule. And it, as you say, most of this is dead or is dying. It wasn't supposed to go into effect until this April. It sort of makes sense on the face of it that your retirement investment advisor should work in your best interest. But, you know, some people are saying that, including Gary Cohn, is saying that this is actually not in the best interest of consumers. How is that so? What's the argument there?
I would respectfully disagree with Mr. Cohn. I think it is definitely in the best interest of consumers to get advice that's unconflicted. Mr. Cohn might be saying is that maybe it's in the best interest of consumers to find out where else they could put their money, right? So maybe, you know, maybe you want to know about an annuity you should buy or an insurance policy you should buy. And that view would overlook the fact that very often banks abuse this. In fact, Wells Fargo just paid a giant fine for abusing that very thing and selling products that people didn't need, opening checking accounts for them that they didn't even know about. So I think the view of Wall Street is the more they can sell you, the better it is for you as well as them. But I think if you're a consumer, you know instinctively that it's better for you if you have somebody protecting you and protecting your money. And so that issue of trust is very much at the center of that conversation. They want you to trust them, but they also want to make money off of you. And that's a very difficult equation.
All right, let me play a clip of tape of the president today talking about Dodd-Frank.
We expect to be cutting a lot out of Dodd-Frank because, frankly, I have so many people, friends of mine, that have nice businesses. They can't borrow money. They just can't get any money because the banks just won't let them borrow.
So friends of his have nice businesses that can't borrow money. Is that actually a problem?
It might be a problem. I don't know who the president's friends are, but what we do know is that if they're having trouble borrowing, it's not because of Dodd-Frank and it's not because of regulation. The banks make those decisions themselves, and there are no limits on who a bank can lend to, except who the bank doesn't want to lend to. So if Mr. Trump's friends or President Trump's friends aren't getting those loans, it's likely because they're not qualifying for those loans according to the bank's own rules. What happened after the financial crisis is banks got really scared. They were lending to people and they were lending to companies, and those loans were not being paid back when it came down to it. So they just really made their lending requirements incredibly strict, which you know if you've tried to apply for a credit card or a mortgage. President Trump's friends are going through the exact same thing, except they're applying for multi-million dollar loans. But it really comes from the bank's own worries about not getting paid back and also worries about getting sued, because after the financial crisis, they made a lot of bad loans and they got sued and they paid millions of dollars in fines. And there's nothing from the government that is causing that. That's the executive's decisions at those banks.
So if Dodd-Frank hasn't gone into effect, what is holding banks back from making risky investments these days?
There are a huge number of factors in that, and they all have to do with the markets and where the world economy is at this point. One thing we've been dealing with is very low interest rates. So if you lend money, you know interest rates are a huge factor in that. We have very low interest rates. It's very hard for banks to make money on loans now, right? They were doing it for a while, but all of their profits from that have faded. They used to make a lot of money trading bonds. So if you have treasury bonds that maybe somebody gave you when you were a kid, or if you have them in your retirement account, those were something that banks considered a very easy way to make money. They could trade those bonds and make a ton of money. That business has also made them a lot less profit, so they're struggling with that. The core banking business, your checking account, your savings account, that's making banks very little money. So they're getting squeezed from a huge number of places, but that all has to do with the world economy, right? So a lot of the world economy has slowed down. People are trying to save more if they can, and that's hit them. It really has nothing to do with regulation.
All right. Heidi Moore, breaking it down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Heidi Moore is a business journalist, currently editor-in-chief at The Ladders. All right, let's talk about some other big business news now. Snap Inc. has filed for a $3 billion IPO. That's the parent company of Snapchat. The IPO is reportedly the largest ever for a company based in Los Angeles. It says nearly 160 people use Snapchat every day. They use it to take selfies, often with filters that make them vomit rainbows or look like puppies. And they share video stories of their days and they get news updates. For many, it's their main news source and main social media network. Here is Snap CEO Evan Spiegel.
The mobile phone has really empowered this idea of instant expression, which is showing someone where you are and how you're feeling in the moment. And this is important as it relates to identity, because really that's one of the things that's at the core of social media.
All right, let's talk more about Snapchat with Sarah Fryer, technology reporter for Bloomberg. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Okay, so this evolved from a frat house at Stanford, I understand, two guys getting together and coming up with an idea into this. Can you talk about the evolution of Snap?
This is a company that made a few really big bets. First of all, that we would want to share things camera first. So when you go to Facebook, you already kind of know what you want to share. You already have thought about the pictures or what you want to say. When you go to Snapchat, it's opening to the camera, and then you just take pictures or video of whatever you're experiencing in that moment. And that's what Snapchat wanted to do, this sort of like raw communication, the very, very personal, you know, not the filtered, edited Instagrams. And what that's evolved into is something very, very different. It's something that Facebook loves to copy. It's an app that now has, as you mentioned, a media component, a chat component. There are Snap Stories, which are when people upload publicly, their snaps get curated into you know, their story of their day, and then they can be used by Snap, the company, to create these big compilations of what's happening at Trump's inauguration or the Women's March or the protests at the airports. You know, they can compile these things, and it's not always new. Sometimes it's like Miss Universe pageant or something like that.
Yeah, and then they disappear.
And then they disappear after 24 hours. Or if you're sending a direct message, it disappears the second after someone looks at it.
Okay. So Snap has not made money. In fact, last year it lost $514 million. Why yes. is this now the big IPO that everyone is, you know, slobbering over?
Well, they lost $514 million, but they made $404 million. Now, that's less than their losses, but that revenue is a 7x growth from the year before. So what investors see here is a fast-growing company. And when there's growth, there's a high valuation because investors are willing to pay the premium for that. And then there's the other aspect of just how much a dearth of IPOs there have been in the last couple of years. There really hasn't been a lot of big offerings like this for investors to put their money into. So whether or not they totally agree with Snap's business model, the IPO is going to have a lot of participation in it.
But can regular people participate in that?
You know, I think it depends on who they decide to sell to. We haven't really gotten a sense of how many retail investors, that's what they're called by bankers, retail investors will be able to be let into the IPO. But certainly once it's trading publicly, anyone can buy shares. Whether they should look at the filing that just came out yesterday because, as you mentioned, the losses are very high. The user growth is starting to slow, it seems. There is a lot of promise, but they don't really go into detail about their future in the way some other founders in technology have done at the time of their IPO. There's no founder letter.
Yeah. So are people saying that this could be the next Facebook? I mean, there are, 158 million users of Snapchat and a couple billion users of Facebook. So there's a big curve there, steep curve there. But is that what people are thinking, that this is the next big thing?
Well, actually, I think when you look at the numbers, you have the nice-looking revenue, the mounting losses, the slowing user growth. Those are a lot of ingredients that are very similar to what we saw in Twitter's filing when it went public. And Snap does not want to be compared to Twitter, but investors are certainly going to be asking the same questions as they did for Snap. As they did in Twitter's IPO, which caused a lot of concern over the last few years. There's been a lot of executive turmoil there, a lot of strategic changes. This year, they're spinning off businesses, laying off workers, trying to go to profitability finally. It has been a tumultuous public company for Twitter. So the concern with Snap is that they might fall into the same bucket. Now, in their IPO prospectus, they make a few hedges against that in saying, listen, we don't have the same goals as Facebook and Twitter did. They say, we're not the traditional social media company. When people use Snap, they tell a story in a chronological order. It's not the most recent stuff first, like you see on Twitter. And Snap doesn't want to connect the world to the internet like Facebook. In fact, they don't care if they're used in developed countries. They're focusing on only the most developed markets with healthy advertising ecosystems and smartphones that have good enough quality to send videos and photos and use the lenses like the product requires.
Okay, so they're looking for quality over quantity, I guess, is what they're saying.
Yes, average revenue per user is the metric.
All right. Sarah Fryer, technology reporter for Bloomberg, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And we want to hear from you. How big a role has Snapchat played in your life, if any? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how even Super Bowl commercials cannot avoid politics. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Super Bowl is this Sunday. It's the Patriots from New England against the Atlanta Falcons. I'm not here to talk about the game. Nope. Instead, we're going to talk about one of the Super Bowl's most talked about sideshows, the commercials. Several of this year's commercials have already been posted online. And to round some of them up, I'm joined now by Andrew Walsh and Genevieve Haas. They co-host the podcast After These Messages. It's all about commercials. Hello.
Hey, Madeline, you didn't want us talking about X's and O's of football today. That's what I prepped for.
Nope. But you guys, since this is your podcasting subject, this must be so exciting for you. This is like the Oscars of commercials, right?
Well, we like to say it's our Super Bowl.
Okay. Well, all right. Well, let's talk about the giant, and that's Budweiser. They have a commercial out now that is telling the story of the founder of Budweiser as a German immigrant. There's not a lot of dialogue, but here's a clip.
You don't look like you're from around here.
Welcome to America.
You're not wanted here. Go back home.
Do you think they released that ad in some kind of response to what's happening in the news with immigration?
You know, I don't think that they did. The story of the ad, if you haven't seen it, and you can certainly go and see it on YouTube, is the story of Adolphus Busch, who with Eberhard Anheuser founded Anheuser-Busch. And it's kind of this very idealized, romanticized story of his American journey from Germany to St. Louis, where Anheuser-Busch was founded. It does have a lot of resonance right now because of the debate that's happening around immigration. And I think it's, personally, I think it's actually a nice message. But I have a hard time believing that Budweiser and Anheuser-Busch would deliberately invite controversy. And I think that if they had known what the current news of the day was when they made this, which obviously they didn't make it a week ago, they might have taken their story or their marketing in a different direction.
I will jump in here, though, and say I think it was the chief creative behind this ad said that they'd been working on it for at least a year. So, of course, this has nothing to do with the current political climate. But I would point out that Trump was talking about a wall when he made his announcement a year and a half ago. So, I mean, maybe it's a stretch on my part. I mean, maybe it's just the idea that it's not a direct statement about something, but there, you know, there's a zeitgeist. There's something in the air at times. Genevieve does point out that this story, I'm giving Genevieve credit for this because she actually looked up a little bit more about what the real origin story is. And let's just say this ad takes some liberties.
Yeah, it's a pretty significant reimagining. And also, fun fact, allegedly, anecdotally, Bush is said to have actually preferred wine all of his life. And even though he was the creator of the first mass marketed beer, he always referred to it as, quote, that slop.
Highly romanticized. Okay, moving on to another all-American favorite. KFC is going to air its first ever Super Bowl ad featuring two colonels, played by Rob Riggle and Billy Zane. And here's a teaser for one of the ads. You have to picture Billy Zane with his body painted gold.
Y'all think the key to success is hard work or learning? Wrong. Success isn't earned, it's eaten. And nothing says success like gold. The new delicious KFC Georgia Gold Chicken. With its tangy honey mustard barbecue taste that says, hey world, I eat gold.
I don't know how much TV you watch, Madeline, but this has been an ongoing campaign for the past couple of years now with KFC messing around with different colonels. It all started when they brought Daryl Hammond back to play, you know, the colonel. And this was the first actor to portray the real colonel, who really was a real man. Apparently, Daryl Hammond, according to him, did not know that it was a temporary part. And he was quite surprised when he was replaced by, I think, Norm MacDonald, then Jim Gaffigan, Vincent Kartheiser of Mad Men. I know you know Pete Campbell.
Oh, yeah.
George Hamilton has played him. So now they're messing around in the Super Bowl and having two colonels on the screen at the same time in a lot of these ads. And they don't like each other.
Yeah. So you've got in these little teasers, you've got Rob Riggle, who has been doing it in the most recent past, and Golden Billy Zane, who, by the way, is a national treasure. And their performances, I'm very excited to see the big Super Bowl version, because the teasers have been a lot of fun. They're both really great comedic actors, and they play off each other in a really fun way.
Okay, let's move on to a Squarespace commercial starring John Malkovich. In the ad, he's trying to start his own website. Here's a clip.
How is it that johnmalkovich.com is taken? I'm him. There is a film about me being me.
What the hell is going on? How can you be John Malkovich? How?
That's so meta, you guys.
If people have a little trouble following along without the visuals there, he's staring directly into the camera. It's from the perspective of the computer screen. We are the computer screen in this case, and he's upset that somebody has taken his domain name, of course. This is my favorite ad of the whole bunch this year, at least of the ones we've seen, you know, previous to the Super Bowl. I think it's hilarious. He goes off. I mean, we could only play a snippet there, but he just goes off. He swears like crazy in this. Of course, it's all beeped out. I think it's a little bit edgy. I think it's hilarious. And to me, it stands heads and shoulders above the rest. I think, Genevieve, you would agree that it's been a pretty lackluster group of commercials this year.
Yeah, as we were surveying all of the ones that have been released in advance or teased, or campaigns that have been teased in advance, I have to say this is not, to me, a truly standout year. There's an interesting article that I was reading about. A lot of advertisers seem to be shying away from anything that's really risky or anything that's really kind of innovative, and I think it's because there's a lot of, you know, they're sensing that the populace is very polarized. It's easy to put a foot wrong and offend a big group of people right now. So to me, the way that's playing out in the actual ads that we're seeing is they're pretty well within defined limits. There's not a lot of innovation. And I think that's why this Squarespace one stands out, is that it's interesting, it's a little edgy, and that really stands out. And he's just a funny and compelling performer.
Okay, well, let's talk about Intel. This will be our last ad we talk about. And this one, I don't see this one as being controversial at all, because it stars one of the stars of the Super Bowl. This is Tom Brady, the quarterback for the Patriots. Picture footage of Brady. He's waking up, brushing his teeth, and cooking pancakes.
Intel 360 Replay makes anything look epic. Literally anything. Wait till you see it in the game.
Enough. They get it.
Okay, so what's happening there?
So Tom Brady is just in his house doing a bunch of mundane things in his pajamas, right? Like he's cooking pancakes, and he accidentally drops a pancake on the floor, and he picks it up and he eats it. But while he's doing these mundane things, this 3D 360 replay technology that Intel is bringing us spins the camera around and makes it seem like he's doing these huge action scenes. Am I doing it? You're kind of nodding your head, Genevieve. Is that a good description of what's happening?
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what you're seeing. And then what you hear at the end there is Brady going into the bathroom and telling the camera that's enough. You know, I don't love this ad. I don't, for one thing, I don't think Brady's appeal outside of New England is as universal as perhaps Intel believes. I could be wrong.
You're betraying your bias
just,
there.
Yeah, I never claim to be objective. But it just feels a little, kind of like what I was saying earlier, or, you know, kind of what I was alluding to earlier with this sort of safe, lackluster approach. There's nothing particularly funny about this. And frankly, I know Brady doesn't eat pancakes because there was a whole article that about all the foods that he doesn't eat. And I want to know how did they gin up it to make it look like he was eating a pancake?
Yeah, that's the technology I want to see. We were able to make Tom Brady look like he was eating a real pancake.
He had a pancake double. All right. Well, thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Andrew Walsh and Genevieve Haas. They co-host the podcast After These Messages. All right. Let's hear from you now. What's your favorite Super Bowl commercial of all time? Do you care more about the ads and the performances than the game itself? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we'll have our Friday film reviews and a conversation with Barbara Koppel about her new documentary about YouTube star Gigi Gorgeous.
She got people who were out there who felt they didn't have a friend in the world, and she just said, I love you. So many other people love you. So many other people are out there that are just like you.
How giving makeup tutorials turned into a seven-figure income. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. February often offers a mixed bag of new movies, a little something for everyone. That is certainly the case this week. There's comedy, terror, suspense, teen melodrama, and of course, a buddy cop flick. Matt Atchity and Christy Lemire are here to talk new releases. Christy is co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Welcome back.
Hi, good to see you.
Good to see you. Matt Atchity, editor-in-chief at Rotten Tomatoes and also a co-host of What the Flick.
Always great to be here.
Always great to have you. Okay, let us start with the mature comedy. It's called The Comedian and it stars Robert De Niro as comedian Jackie Burke, Leslie Mann as his love interest. Danny DeVito's in it. Here's a clip.
Isn't it adorable when celebrities bring their hookers to the club? Jackie Burke's in the crowd.
After everything I've done for you, I was there for you when you were starting out as a young man.
That was amazing. I feel like I'm high. Do you come up with all that on the spot?
Sometimes, yeah.
That was good.
Okay, Christy, you saw this one. What did you think?
It's kind of terrible. It's shocking that this thing got made, and it's this long gestating passion project between Robert De Niro, who stars in it, Art Linson, who co-wrote it and produced it, and Taylor Hackford, who directed it. So Robert De Niro stars as this aging comedian. He had been on this really hacky sitcom for a while, and wherever he goes, people want him to do the ridiculous catchphrases from it. He wants to be taken more seriously. He punches out a heckler at a comedy club and has to do community service, where he meets Leslie Mann, who is also there doing community service. And the comedy in this, the stand-up comedy in this, is shockingly unfunny, especially given that Jeffrey Ross co-wrote the script. I mean, he is the roast master. This is his purview, this world of comedians. It never rings true. You have real-life comedians playing themselves or versions of themselves throughout the entire film, from Jim Norton to Hannibal Buress to Gilbert Gottfried and Richard Belzer. And it's never funny. And I wondered halfway through, is it intentionally not supposed to be funny, like when De Niro was in Kings of Comedy, when that was supposed to be terrible stand-up?
That was a brilliant movie,
yes,
King of Comedy.
This is not. And this is weirdly overlong. It keeps not ending. And everyone's laughing uproariously at his stand-up, and it's just never funny. It's this weird experience. Leslie Mann has some nice moments. He and Danny DeVito have some nice moments. They play brothers. Patti LuPone is in this. It's Edie Falco. It's this ridiculous riches within the cast here, and no one gets really very much material to work with.
That's really sad. And also, can we talk about the age difference between De Niro and Leslie Mann?
Oh, that's just a given. That just happens. That's not even shocking anymore. Even shocking anymore,
right.
Yes.
That's called a movie.
Yeah, that's what happens in Hollywood. You have the much, much younger, beautiful love interest.
Right. Not to sound cynical.
But it's true.
All right, let's talk about Buddy Cop, this film. This is called War on Everyone, and here is a clip.
Welcome back, boys. I received a very serious allegation of assault and bribery and corruption charges against you.
Are you trying to bribe us, ma'am?
No.
There'll be no more suspensions from duty.
That's great.
You will be out.
Oh, that's not great.
Okay, Matt, this one stars Alexander Skarsgård and Michael Peña as corrupt cops. Are they funny? Is it worth watching?
They are funny. I'm not totally sure it's worth watching. This movie's kind of a mess, and it's frustrating because it's from director John Michael McDonough, who gave us Cavalry and The Guard, these great Brendan Gleeson movies. So this should be a great movie, and Alexander Skarsgård and Michael Peña play these two cops. Skarsgård is kind of the bigger, hulking, dumber cop, and Peña is this fast-talking, weirdly philosophical and well-read cop, quoting philosophers and busting out these platitudes in the middle of this really viciously mean-spirited movie. This is a movie that starts off with a chase scene as they're running down a mime, and one of them says to the other, if you run over a mime, is he going to say anything? And then they pay off with that joke. They hit the mime and you find out. And the movie does...
That could be funny.
It could be funny. And there are moments that are very funny in a very shockingly vicious way. But it almost feels like somebody dropped the script and when they put it back together, they were missing a few pages. Mm. So the story in a lot of places doesn't work. It feels really disjointed. And it's frustrating because, again, we've seen better films from this director. I liked it largely on the part of the stars here. Skarsgård and Peña have good chemistry. I'm a big fan of Michael Peña, especially kind of when he's doing his smart, fast-talking thing, which he does a lot of in this. Theo James is kind of the heavy in this. Paul Reiser is their lieutenant. It doesn't really get cliched, but partly because you can't ever really figure out what's going on here.
Sounds like he's trying to do a Tarantino movie.
It feels like a European director trying to do almost a satire of American action movies. Mm. And McDonough doesn't quite get there. And it just kind of falls apart, which is frustrating.
Okay, two duds. Let's try for a winner. Let's try. This one wasn't open to reviews on Thursday, right, Christy? This is The Rings we're talking about.
Rings.
Just Rings.
No, just Rings. It's just Rings. It's kind of a sequel and kind of a reboot of the Ring series, which began in Japan as Ringu. This is basically the same movie you have seen over and over again, but just with updated technology, right? Because it's all predicated on this videotape that when you watch it, you die within a week. Right?
Yeah.
First you watch it, then you die.
Okay, here's a clip.
There you go.
Here's a clip.
I keep thinking about this story. There's this video that kills you 7 days after you watch it. The second it's over, the phone rings. And this voice says...
Three movies. Do we need a third?
No, we don't. It's the same exact movie. And I guess they're trying to appeal to another generation of horror fans. The English language Rings movies were from the early 2000s. And now we have flat screen TVs on which to watch this. And now we have, you can watch it on your laptop. You can watch it on your phone. And so the creepy girl with the stringy black hair can crawl out of the well and come get you through your phone now.
Yikes.
And
but she's going to be like 6 inches tall.
Yeah, because you can squash her like
she,
a bug.
She's every size that she needs to be upon whatever occasion it is. And so I guess the sight of her is creepy if you've never seen these before. And the Ring movies have been endlessly parodied. So it's just been done so many times. You have Vincent D'Onofrio in this to try to provide some sort of acting substance. You know, Naomi Watts was in the original ones. It's just more of the same. And they didn't show it to us before it opened. And so I went and paid my $15 at the Grove along with like a dozen other people last night at 8:00. And it's just... the same. It's the same exact movie.
That was an act of sacrifice.
I'm a professional, and I take my job seriously. So it's
also known as martyr.
That too. So it's not very good. I suppose if you haven't seen any of the other Ring movies, it might be scary, but it really is more of the same.
Okay. Three down, one to go. Finally, a teen melodrama. This one is called The Space Between Us. Boy meets street smart girl, and there's a catch.
My name is Gardner Elliott. I was born on Mars, but I finally found a reason to go to Earth.
I could just see her, you know?
His heart can't handle our gravity.
It's too risky.
It's worth it.
You don't realize how far away you are until there's someone you want to be near.
Hey, Tulsa.
So he's from Mars. He goes to Earth to meet a girl.
Yeah.
Are there no Martian girls he could get with?
This movie's terrible. There's a great sci-fi novel about a boy that's born on Mars and comes to Earth and changes everything. And it's called Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein. This is if Nicholas Sparks took the basic concept of that and turned it into a story, you'd get something maybe almost this dumb. This is a really, really bad movie. So this kid grows up to be 16 years old. He's still on Mars. There's a discussion about why no one can know that he's still around. And the astronauts that go there have kind of raised him. And then somebody.
But he's a human, right?
He's a human. Mm-hmm. And they bring him back to Earth. But, oh, it's tough to be on Earth. The gravity's too heavy. But he finds the girl who's going to help him find his father. And it's just dumb and as corny as you could possibly imagine. And then you get to the climax of this movie and it starts to feel like they ran out of money. And they almost, it's as if they sweeted their own movie. The climax of this is so silly. I mean, everything in this movie kind of takes you out of it because it is so loopy and dopey and it hits every cliched mark really incompetently. And then as you get to this almost chase scene to get the boy back to space, it manages to take you out of a movie that you're not even in to begin with.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Okay.
I reviewed this for RogerEbert.com, and I called it a Muppet Babies version of Starman. Because they do. He meets this girl he's had this online flirtation with, and they go on a road trip to California. And you have actors like Gary Oldman and Carla Gugino, who in theory can bring some substance and then maybe some vague glimmers of emotional truth, but that never happens. There's an exploding barn in this movie. We had so much fun. I got to mention, because we were all sitting together laughing our heads off. The screenwriter of this is Alan Loeb, who also wrote Collateral Beauty, which is one of the most unintentionally hilarious movies of last year. He goes big with the melodrama. He's ambitious with it. Maybe if you're a tween girl, you'll think it's tragic and romantic and exciting. But we were just giggling the whole time.
Or just rent Man Who Fell to Earth.
Yeah.
A David Bowie movie.
Right.
Much better.
Yeah, this is a terrible movie.
February. It might be worse than January. It might.
Oh my gosh. Four dogs.
Next weekend will be good, but this weekend, stay home, watch the Super Bowl.
Next weekend's 50 Shades Darker.
Ooh.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Can't wait for that. Okay. Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Matt Atchity, also co-host of What the Flick and editor-in-chief at Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for your sacrifice. And coming up on this program, we'll have the director of the new documentary, Gigi Gorgeous. We'll talk about her. She's the YouTube star turned trans hero. Her story next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Gigi Gorgeous has built a fan base of nearly 2.5 million YouTube subscribers. She started out as Gregory Gorgeous, giving makeup tutorials back in 2008. Then online, she came out as gay, then trans. She's documented her plastic surgery operations, her romantic life, and she has built a big business, putting it all online for her fans. Now, documentary filmmaker Barbara Koppel has put it all into a film. It's called This Is Everything, Gigi Gorgeous. It opens in theaters this weekend. I sat down with Barbara Koppel at Sundance a couple of weeks ago, and I asked her why she wanted to make a movie about Gigi Gorgeous.
somebody called me up and asked me, they said, how would you like to do a film on this incredible woman who has over 2.5 million subscribers and she's on YouTube and her story is amazing. So I said, how could I resist? And the first thing I did was I started sifting through all of her, you know, YouTube pieces and GoPro pieces, and that became the spine of the film.
Hi guys, it's me, Gigi. And today I wanted to talk to you guys and kind of just set the record straight on any plastic surgery that I have had done. I am finally ready to talk about it now, so I thought that I would give you the whole lowdown.
I met Gigi and she was like sunshine. She was just this beautiful woman and she treated everybody so wonderfully. Like if you were putting makeup on her, she'd say, so are you gonna put makeup on me? And the person would say yes, and she'd hug them. So she just had such goodness. And I learned so much about her also from the YouTube pieces because it showed how she changed a whole community. She got people who were out there who felt they didn't have a friend in the world, felt I'm different, I'm odd, you know, no one understands me, my parents kicked me out, maybe I'll commit suicide, I just don't have any other choices. And what she did is she brought them in and she just said, I love you, so many other people love you, so many other people are out there that are just like you.
Now, she started out as just doing makeup tutorials on YouTube when she was...
Before that, she was Gregory Gorgeous.
Gregory Gorgeous, oh my goodness, he changed my life. Before I watched his coming out story, I was like, I'm never gonna tell anyone that I'm gay. I'm just going to keep it to myself for the rest of my life. Literally, a week after I watched his coming out story, I started telling people.
Gregory Gorgeous was an incredible athlete. He was a diver. And he won the Nationals in Toronto and was about to go to the Olympics. But something wasn't right. And so he felt much happier being on YouTube and doing makeup tutorials and didn't go any further.
My thoughts just had such a strong hold on me. I was thinking about things like heels and lipstick. Why was I thinking these things? Why did I want to dress up? Why did I like makeup? It's just something that I had to explore.
But he didn't set out to be a hero to transgender youth.
No. Gigi just set out to be herself. And she just wasn't comfortable in the skin that she was in. And she was incredibly courageous, and she just went through all the steps. And she also had the luxury of a family who adored her. And even though they probably didn't understand her, they loved her.
I have felt for a very long time now that I was a girl trapped inside of a boy's body. Basically, this video is kind of me just telling you guys that I want to be female. It's still my heart, it's still my body, it's still my mind. I'm just choosing to be identified as a different gender.
Has she experienced any kind of negative reaction, and how does she deal with that when it comes up?
Yes, she went to Dubai and she couldn't get in. And she was devastated by that. So the people she was with went in and she had to stay at the airport for 5 or 6 hours or whatever it was. And she never got in. And then when Dubai found out that she was getting so much publicity, they wrote an I'm sorry note. It was a computer mess up.
It's also a story, interestingly, about the internet age, about the power of YouTube, about regular people becoming celebrities as well and what that looks like. And as someone who has worked in film and television for a very long time, what did you learn about this new world of media?
I learned about people being able to express themselves and be heard, because many times as young people, we're not heard. Our voices are silenced. And it also allows young people to go further into what they want to do. We just had a panel, and it was the end of the panel, and they said, okay, that's enough. And I saw this young woman out of the corner of my eye just tentatively putting her hand up. And so I just said, please, can't we have one more question? And the mic went to her, and she just said, I just came out. And she said, people didn't like me, and they said mean things to me. And I tried to get my school to do an assembly on, you know, coming out. And my school wouldn't do it, and I've been ostracized. And, of course, some people love me, but many, many don't. And she just burst into tears in the middle of the panel. And so I think that what YouTube and what other places are doing for people who are able to get on there and to really communicate is to give them love in the face of so much hate.
And this young woman lives in Utah?
Yes, she lives in Utah.
I want to talk about the representation of femininity here, mm-hmm. because I think Gigi goes through great lengths to create her look. And it's a look you could describe as a Barbie doll look. It's very inflated boobs and the long blonde hair and the big lips and the skinny body and the tan and et cetera, and the makeup, blah, blah, blah. And I guess I'm wondering that since she's so much about freedom of expression and being who you are, why does she feel the need to create her look in such a narrow definition of what femininity is?
Well, I it's hard to speak for her, but as I look at her, I just see that this is who I am. I want to be glamorous. I feel alive when I'm glamorous. I'm not doing it for anyone other than myself. And she takes pride in being beautiful. So the name Gigi Gorgeous. And she tries to get everybody to be gorgeous. I mean, she looked at me today, you know, and she's wearing a pink, you know, sort of faux fur kind of coat. And she said, I'll look in my closet and see what I can bring out for you. And I said, I would love that. Give me some color. We're known from New York when we come here as the women in black. And I opened my closet, and, you know, it's like black and a little blue or green or something like that. But
and she's made quite a business of this. She makes a lot of money being Gigi Gorgeous.
Yeah. My understanding is I think she makes 7 figures, and that's through advertising and sponsoring, and but it's a lot of work. You have to really divest of yourself on almost a daily or, you know, couple of days a week basis, edit everything, really expose your raw emotions, what's happening in your life. So it's very big therapy for people. Because I think in this day and age when we have so much untruths or faux truths, it's really wonderful to be able to see somebody laying it out there and being who they are no matter what that is, her good days, her bad days, and she's fascinating.
What is her future? Does she look 10 years down the line and think, I'm still going to be doing YouTube videos?
I would love to be in a movie. I would love to write a book. I would love to have a fragrance line, a clothing line. I would love to have a husband, a kid, a house, a dog. Or maybe learn how to cook too, because they don't know how to cook.
She would say, oh, they're very corny things I want, but that's what I want more than anything.
So like a traditional life that she grew up in, this traditional
yes.
family?
Exactly like a life that she grew up in. I mean, her father, I think if all of us had fathers like him, I mean, I had a great father, we'd be very lucky.
You know, it definitely was difficult to lose Greg. I mean, I had 3 boys. But having Greg happy is way more important than me having old Greg.
That's very moving. It's very sweet. And I think that's one of the things that a lot of trans kids suffer with is the non-acceptance from their parents.
Yes, the trans kids suffer with that a lot. There's a lot of suicide. There's just a lot of anguish and hurt and feeling like you're outside of it all and having such a tough time. And I think part of what Gigi tries to do is to let them know that there are so many people like them and that there's so many people that care about them, and just get rid of those people, you know, who make you feel bad, and become part of a community where you can really talk about issues and talk about ideas and move forward in your life.
Well, Barbara Cobble, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I am 100% who I am. I'm not gonna hold back. I'm just telling you guys, seriously, just be yourself. If you like something, get it. If you want to do something, do it. If you want to act one way, act it. Because one day you're going to wake up really, really angry, and you're just going to say, why am I hiding who I am? You know what I mean? But I will talk to you guys later, and until then, stay gorgeous.
The always gorgeous Jolie Myers.
I'm back at you, Madeline Brand, and our listeners are gorgeous as well. In the waning seconds of the show, I'm just asking for your comments. We love to see them. We love to interact with you. We're on Facebook, KCRW Press Play, Twitter at the same address.
All right. Thank you so much. Hey, you guys have a really great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I will see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.